Hi again, everybody. I'm Dan Hoard, and thanks for downloading the Bengals Booth Podcast, the Just When They Think They've Got You Game Set Match. Here comes the comeback. Edition is Joe Burrow and offensive line coach Frank Pollock return to Paul Brown Stadium. Coming up, Dave Lapham joins me for a 30-minute conversation as we discuss those comebacks and answer the Ask Lap questions that you submitted on Twitter. Plus, we'll talk to special teams coordinator and assistant head coach Darren Simmons. The Bengals Booth Podcast is presented by Bud Light Seltzer. Refresh the game. And here's a quick reminder that you can have the latest edition of this podcast delivered right to your phone, tablet, or computer by subscribing on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or Podbean. It's the greatest thing since a new toothbrush. I went to the dentist last week. Shout out to Dr. Eric Lenz. And as is always the case, I left his office with a little goodie bag, including a new toothbrush. And the first time I brushed my teeth with it, I was reminded of how good it feels to use a brand new one. According to the American Dental Association, a toothbrush is typically in good working order for about 3 to 4 months. So, if it's been longer than that, and the brushes are frayed and pointing every which way, buy yourself a new toothbrush. It'll put a smile on your face. Hopefully, an even brighter one. Now, time for Dave Lapham to answer my questions and yours. Lap, let's start with the return of Joe Burrow to Cincinnati. He'll be rehabbing 5 days a week at Paul Brown Stadium, and he did a Zoom call with reporters on Tuesday. What stood out to you in that Zoom call?
I think his positive attitude about the rehab. I think that he feels like he's a quick healer. The torn rotator cuff that he had surgery on and the quick healing process that he's gone through already from a rehab standpoint, I think, is an indicator, you know, that's how his body type is, which is encouraging. And, you know, the thing about him is every grind is a challenge. And this might be the biggest grind slash challenge of his career, obviously. But I think he's up to it. I think in his mind, he wants to have the training staff and the rehab people say, he's the best we ever had. Joe Burrow wants to be number one in everything. And that's the way he approaches it. And I think that's a good thing, obviously.
I liked how he acknowledged the need to be better on the deep ball. I think sometimes athletes will kind of dance around something that was a weakness or a problem. And he addressed that head on, even saying that he needs to get bigger and stronger.
Yeah. I think sometimes guys, players, really good players, are the last ones to realize they still have things they need to get better at. You know, they quote, think they've arrived as such. I don't think Joe Burrow is the kind of guy that'll ever think he's arrived. I think he's one of those guys that is always going to, you know, strive to be better, find a weakness, build on that, and then take a positive and make that even better. You know, I think he just across the board, he's always never going to be satisfied. Always going to want to strive to be better. And that's what makes the good ones great.
He said something else that caught my ear. And this also gets back to something he said in his interview with Colin Cowherd last week. When Cowherd talked to him about what he can improve on from his rookie year, what lessons he learned, he specifically brought up the Colts game and said he learned that when it's 21-0 in the NFL, you cannot take your foot off the gas pedal.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, today's offenses, the way people can attack, the excellence at the quarterback position, no lead is safe. There's no question about it. That's why, you know, in the Pittsburgh-Cleveland game, when they jumped out to that 21-0 lead, I thought, well, you know, that's a good indicator that that this game could turn out well for them tonight, but it's certainly not over. And, you know, even Chris and Al were talking about when they, in the third quarter, it was still a two-score game plus. They're like, this football game's not over. And that's just life in the National Football League. There's no question about it. And that's something that, you have to adjust to for sure.
So Burrow hopes to be throwing in mid-February, 12 weeks after surgery. And he seems confident that he'll be ready to go in time for week one of the regular season next year. Do you have any concern about him pushing too hard?
I think that's always a concern with the guy of Joe Burrow's makeup. You know, Joe is he's a very self-motivated guy. You don't have to light a firecracker under Joe's butt to get him going, man. You know, he wakes up ready to roll every single day. So I think that, honestly, yeah, the thing that you have to think about if you're directing his rehab, like Nick Cosgrave is going to, Nick is excellent. Nick's as good as there is in the world, really, in doing what he does, is you don't have to put a harness on him and continue to pull him back. You don't have to worry about pushing him. He's going to push himself. But, you know, if you feel like, boy, you know, my experience tells me, even though he might be able to do it at this stage, might be doing a little too much, I'm going to pull him back, pull the reins a little bit, and, you know, try to tame this wild bronkin' buck right now. I think that's kind of the mindset that everybody's going to have to approach it with. And Joe's going to have to realize that these guys know, you know, it's not anything personal. It's not like they're trying to, you know, retard your rehab process or anything like that. But you have to have trust and faith in your rehab people to make sure that you don't become your own worst enemy. You know, you don't do too much, because there are going to be setbacks, and you don't want there to be self-imposed setbacks. Those are the worst setbacks to have when you do it to yourself.
All right, let's move on to the return of Frank Pollock as the offensive line coach. Were you at all surprised the Bengals were able to lure him back, considering that Zach didn't try to keep him in the first place when Frank was still under contract a couple of years ago?
Yeah, that was an interesting situation. I think it shows that both men aren't small, you know? I mean, it was a situation where, all right, Zach had made a commitment that he was going to go with Jim Turner. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that Mike Brown would have liked Zach to interview, you know, Frank, and see what he thought. But at that point, I think Frank, through the grapevine or whatever, I think he knew that, you know, Zach had his guy, Jim Turner. So I think I'm going to credit Mike Brown on this. Obviously, Frank asked Mike Brown probably to say, look, would you please just let me go? Because I have opportunities out there. Don't make it a situation where you might want me to hang around and interview with a guy that I know has already made his mind up. Can I go somewhere else and take advantage of an opportunity that might present itself? So bottom line is, no bridges were burned anywhere. You know, I think there was a healthy dose of respect everywhere. Frank said right away that he appreciated the way that he was treated by the Brown family upon his return. So it tells me that not only the way he was treated while he was here, but when he exited, he was treated with respect. So I think the fact that that's the way they parted ways, I think, led to coming back together again. And I think the run game coordinator, even though, you know, it's just a title, how much responsibility will come with that title? I think there will be some. And I think that, you know, in the progression of Frank Pollock's career, to have that title in addition to offensive line coach, and probably economically was a benefit as well to have that title. Then you come back and put things back together again. And I see them working well together. And the good thing is, the players that were here when Frank was here the first time are excited about his return. And that's always a big plus.
Joe Mixon among them. Joe Burrow told us in that Zoom interview yesterday that Joe Mixon called him up after Frank Pollock was announced and was, quote, hooting and hollering. Why do you think Frank is so popular among players?
I think it's his whole approach to the game of football. You know, some guys talk about their love of the game. Frank doesn't have to talk about it. He just shows it all the time. It oozes out of his pores, you know. And he played, you know, he played 9 years in the NFL as a player. So he understands a lot of what the guys are thinking, what they're going through, you know, from firsthand experience. And I think that's always a plus. I mean, I think he feels like he can relate to the locker room because he did as a player, and he knows the type of coach that he respected as a player. So he wants to be that type of coach and make sure that he builds those kind of relationships. So I think all of that is a part of the equation. Plus, you know, he's damn good at what he does. I mean, he's really a good, he teaches not only schematic, not only does he teach a good scheme that you can believe in. And that's very important. Are you honestly buying what your coach is selling? And I think with Frank, guys really do consume and buy everything he's selling in terms of his schematic, his technique, And he doesn't just teach technique. He teaches, you know, how to execute the technique. Here's what I want you to do, and here's why I want you to do it. And when you have those questions answered, you know, it's much easier to digest, you know. And I think he also is, as a former player, I think he felt like when I come off the field, if I have something to say to my coach, I hope my coach listens to it, you know, and appreciates it a little bit. So I think he realizes he knows that Hopkins is smart. He knows Bobby Hart's smart. He knows there are some smart guys, intelligent football IQ guys in that up front. If they come off the field and say something, you know, it's, I don't know if I can believe that. I think there's a trust there, you know, that develops between the line coach and the lineman. And I think that's a big factor. I've always said that when a coach has both, they both respect and like, I mean, that's, and you don't necessarily have to like them, but when that does happen, when you have both, man, there's a synergistic effect there. And I've said before, and I still maintain that the guy that I saw that the best example of that I've ever seen is Dick LeBeau. I don't think there's one ex-player of Dick LeBeau, whether he was, quote, disgruntled about lack of playing time or whatever, that does not love and respect Dick LeBeau as a coach. That's hard to do. And I think Frank, because of, you know, his experience as a player, Dick was a, you know, Hall of Fame player as well as a Hall of Fame coach. Frank was, played a long time in the National Football League. That's hard to do. And I think players both respect, you know, and like Frank as well.
Use of the word synergistic has just elevated the intelligence level of this podcast. So thank you very much. Billy Price is another guy who very publicly came out in support of this move. He clearly looks at it like a new lease on life. Do you think Billy or anybody else in particular benefits from the return of Frank Pollock?
I think that the thing that you have to go with into it with, and I think Frank is doing it as well, it's a clean slate, you know. I'm going to start by examining tape and see what I see with my own eyes in terms of what talent is available to me on the current roster, who's approaching free agency, who's back for sure, all those kind of things. Can they play? But, you know, Billy had a great relationship with Frank when they were first together. So you would expect that to continue. And Billy is looking for a fresh start, obviously, a new lease on life as such. The thing that Billy has to do is continue to try to improve on the areas where he's had problems. And in my mind, his big thing is balance. Because of his arms being a little bit short, he's out of balance a lot. You know, he's overextended, his chin's over his skis, and you know, he's on the ground some. So that's the biggest thing. I don't care who the coach is, if they can't figure out together with the player how to keep that player in balance and let him, you know, stay on his feet and finish plays, you know, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, maybe Frank has some ideas to help Billy with that, you know, that Jim didn't. And maybe Billy can respond to that and make an adjustment. And it's all about, you know, adjustments. And sometimes a coaching change is just what a player needs. People say, oh, he went to a fresh start, new location, you know, new environment. You can get that internally instead, not necessarily a new place, but a new environment. I mean, it's the guy you deal with every single day at practice, your coach. When that changes, everything changes.
So offensive line coach is filled. Troy Walters is reportedly being promoted to become the wide receivers coach. They still have vacancies at defensive line coach and running backs coach, as far as we know, at least. Any thoughts on what they should be looking for there?
If I'm the head coach, get together with the rest of my position coaches on offense and say, who have you coached with that you really think is an outstanding running back? Give me your guys' input. Who do you think would mesh well, you know, with the rest of these coaches? Who do you think would mesh well with the type of personalities we have, you know, players that they're going to be coaching? And there's always some, you know, a list can be made up of that. Because then the mesh would be easier because there'd be some familiarity a little bit. And the same with defense. I would sit down, you know, if I'm Lou Anarumo or Zach, you know, I'd sit down with Lou and offense, sit down with Brian Callahan and say, no, make a list based on what your assistants are saying and you. Make me a list of guys that you feel would mesh well, marry well with the rest of our coaching staff, and let's target them. Instead of doing this big, you know, bullseye target, why don't we bullseye it a little bit and see if we can come up with somebody that would fit in philosophically, what we're trying to do, how we're trying to teach it, all those kind of things.
All right. I am putting you in the shoes of Duke Tobin.
Yes.
Give me your top three priorities in order.
You're talking about from a position standpoint?
Yes, sir.
I would talk about initially both lines of scrimmage, Dan, one and two, you know, however you want to do it, one and 1A. It doesn't, because even in this era of all kinds of formations, all kinds of personnel groupings, window dressing, motion, jet sweep, all this crap, who advanced in the playoffs? The teams that won the line of scrimmage, period. The teams that won the line of scrimmage. Cleveland beat Pittsburgh up front on both sides of the ball. I was very surprised about it, but I guess I shouldn't have been, because Cleveland Pro Football Focus has the Cleveland Browns number one rated run team, run game O-line and pass protection O-line. Mm. And they played that way. So I think it starts there. It starts there. I think you have to find out who you're going to be able to make sure you don't lose anything in free agency, obviously, and what you might be able to retain in free agency, and then go to the draft and approach it accordingly based on what happened in free agency first and foremost. But then I would address both lines of scrimmage initially. I'm a firm believer in, you know, I think whenever guys have big games, guys up front played well as well and gave an opportunity. You know, you can have very talented players, and they can look very average if the offensive line is getting overwhelmed by the defensive line and vice versa.
So if O-line and D-line are one and two in either order, do you have a third priority?
You know, I would, depending on what happens on the back end, I just think, you know, if I've got my defensive line addressed and my offensive line addressed, I'm looking at, you know, somebody to cover people on the back end. I do think it's a passing league still. Even though teams that are running the football did well in the playoffs, Cleveland ran it well. Obviously, Baltimore ran it well. We know that the AFC North, all other than Pittsburgh now, which is crazy for me to even think to say and then say it, they can't run the football. That's amazing. But I think having a cover guy back there, but still in my mind, Dan, you can still get away with not having top-notch cover people if you have an outstanding pass rush. If you have no pass rush, you have to address the back end. But even with that, you can't cover people forever back there. It's impossible. The athletes are too good. So if pass rush and coverage go hand in hand, it's yin and yang. But I would still try to improve both of those areas in that side of the football.
All right. I threw out an invitation on Twitter for Ask Lap questions. They came pouring in this week, many about the draft. Uh-huh. So we'll start with Sam, and basically many people ask the same question with different wording. Did the performance of Alabama wide receiver Devontae Smith in the national championship game make you rethink what the Bengals should do with the fifth pick? And JT put it this way. If Penei Sewell, Ja'Marr Chase, and Devontae Smith are all there at number five, who do you think the Bengals should take?
I'm like following along what I talked about just a little bit ago. I'm a Sewell guy at that point. I think all those guys are phenomenal players, great weapons. But, you know, T. Higgins, Tyler Boyd still have guys. If you don't have people up front that are giving your quarterback an opportunity to not be affected by what the first stage of it is, oh my God, I don't want to be watching the pass rush and being concerned there. I got to get my eyes downfield to coverage. And if you're getting hit, quarterbacks, I mean, they don't get their eyes downfield as quickly as they should, you know, and there's a whole, and then it just kind of unfolds and unravels from there. But I've seen great skill people wasted because they weren't given an opportunity to perform. But if honestly, Sewell's gone, for example, at number five, and I think he might go as high as number two, I think the Jets might take him at number two. So if he and you know, and try to develop Darnold and that tackle would help develop him. They have one, and maybe try to get the bookend tackle and see if Darnold can develop. But if Sewell is gone and the next tackle is, you know, on my board is down there at, you know, 10 or 11 and I'm picking at five, and I've got these receivers that would be closer to the top five, I'd stay true to my board. You know, I would think about it at that point in time. I still would always, if it's close, I would draft by need if it's not a huge disparity in where I have them ranked on my board. But if there's a pretty good disparity there, if it, you know, you're dropping out of the top five with a guy, you're picking at fifth, and you're dropping out of the top five, and you're maybe barely staying in the top 10 with a position of need, I might stay true to my board and see if I can get it done early in the second round with the bigger need.
A related question to that from JoJo Jammer. If you trade down, how far are you willing to go?
If I'm trading down, I've got to have at least two guys in mind that I'd be comfortable with. So if I'm trading down to, say, number 12, and I don't think one of the two guys that I'm comfortable with trading back, I think there's no way that both of them are going to be gone. I'd trade back. But if my mind is dicey, if both of them might be gone, I wouldn't trade back that far. You know, I would never trade back thinking I have this guy in mind and that's the guy that's going to, you never know. You have to have a plan B. In my mind, you can never trade back if you don't have two people that, you know, on your board aren't, there's not a big disparity with them on the board. They're about the same spot on the board, maybe a couple of different positions, but at the same spot on the board that you'd be good with if you traded back and then getting the additional pick, you might be able to address the other need that you had of the two options, you know, with that extra pick or your fifth pick in the second round. But I would never trade back for one specific guy thinking, oh, I'm going to get him. Man, the draft's fickle. Telling you, you'll get slapped right across the face and doing that.
From Three Kid Taxi. Great title, by the way. And this is related to the possibility of potentially drafting Devontae Smith. Is there a fear of drafting players from Alabama? It seems like they have injury issues once they're selected.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because particularly at the running back position, because Nick Saban works those horses. I mean, he runs those horses. He doesn't walk them around the track, man. They're always running. and his practices are pretty physical. So there has been, you know, a very pretty long history of running backs that have been injured when they're at Alabama, either that or come out and are injured pretty quickly early in their career, because, you know, it does, in my mind, it does make a ton of sense. You only have so many carries in that body, you know, physical carries. And if you're burning them up early, you know, that's a little bit of a consideration. But to me, the trend was so dynamic that it wasn't just, oh, that's a coincidence. You know, there has to be a little bit more to it than that. But at the receiver position, I'm not really sure. I mean, the thing about Smith that is going to concern people, he's 177 pounds. You know, he was a buck 66 when he was a freshman at Alabama, and they beefed him up an unbelievable 11 pounds, you know, but he's wiry. He's still strong, but in the SEC and the playoffs, those are good players, but the NFL is a cut above. I mean, the NFL, the corners run faster. When he beat the Ohio State linebacker, I'm not saying he's not going to beat a linebacker in the NFL, but it might be a better match than it was in that college game. They hit hard. They're bigger, faster, stronger, and can run. So that means there's going to be bigger impact. And, you know, you always worry about a guy at that size, you know, with that kind of impact, coming across the middle of the football field, for example, or what have you. So, I guess that's something that you have to think about. He's overcome it at every level. And when guys overcome it to the level that he has in terms of the best, he came out of nowhere. I mean, this guy, he wasn't even the number one receiver at Alabama going into the season until there was injury, broken ankle. And you gotta give him a ton of respect, but it's a small sample size, but it's a hellacious sample size. There's no doubt about it.
From Bengals Bobby, did you respond better in your playing days to a Jim Turner coaching style or a Frank Pollock coaching style?
Back when I played, it was more universally a Jim Turner coaching style. And so you didn't really experience, I'm not saying it didn't happen, and I'm not saying I didn't have coaches, line coaches, a couple that weren't more like the Frank Pollock coaching style. And I think the Frank Pollock coaching style in today's NFL works better. because players, I mean, it's not that we didn't want to ask why, but you just didn't. It just, that was the culture. What a coach said was gospel. And whether you believe it or not, you better change your beliefs because it's gospel. Today, and I think this has improved the game. Today, everybody says, why coach? Just tell me why, just so I can understand it better. I think that you have to change with the times. I think coaches have to adapt. And I think, personality and being able to deal with different players, nobody's the exact same physically. And that's where I think Frank basically excels, is he's got his techniques, Dan, but it's not like one size fits all. Well, we may have to modify this technique because you've got short arms. You have a long trunk, but shorter arms. And you can do this because you have long arms and a shorter trunk. Not everybody's the same physically. So he does a good job of being malleable with his technique to be able to, be an amoeba, and adjust to all the different body types. Same with the personalities. I mean, nobody's the exact same personality-wise. So if you're going to adjust how you do things from a technique standpoint, and I think they're much better doing that these days, line coaches are in the NFL. Back in the day, it was more like, this is what we're doing it, boys, and this is how we're doing it, and no questions asked. Yes, sir, coach. And now it's much different. Here's what I want done, but if your body doesn't really quite able to handle that, let's figure out a way to adjust that technique a little bit. And the same thing with input on how to block a certain configuration or whatever the case may be. I think you do have to have a different working relationship with players. And I'm not saying, the thing about Frank that I respect, Dan, is he does listen, but he's the decision maker. It's not a democracy. It's not a dictatorship, but he'll listen, but he's still the decision maker. They're not going to make the decision for him, but he's going to listen and get feedback, and decide. And I think that's all valuable. I think players appreciate it.
All right. I'm going to combine questions from Tim and Ryan. Tim asked, do you think the Bengals will sign a couple of veteran offensive linemen in the free agent market? Ryan asked, which free agent offensive lineman would you target? And he listed these names: Joe Tooney, Brandon Scherff, John Miller, Alejandro Villanueva, and Austin Blythe. I'll throw in a couple of others that are out there: Trent Williams and Taylor Moten. So, will they sign veteran offensive linemen? And is there anybody that would especially excite you?
Yeah, I haven't looked at that much tape of a lot of these guys to see how they're playing currently. The one thing that I would not do is sign somebody based on reputation. It's because I'm telling you, we see it. Some players get to a certain stage of their career and they fall off a cliff. Other players don't. And you never know where that cliff is, and you never know when that fall is starting. So from one year to the next, the level of play of a guy may be dramatically different. And if you give a guy a ton of money based on how he performed, over the last 3 years, but that last year wasn't really as good as the other two, I wouldn't want to get caught in that trap. All those guys are really good football players, or they have been. I would not give a lot of money to Villanueva at this stage of his career. I think he's definitely on the back nine. And, if Pittsburgh wants to pay him for being a great player for them all those years, great. But if I'm the Bengals, I'm not going to pay him for being a great Steeler. I want him to be a great Bengal. I'm not interested in what he did with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And it's that way with everybody. And sometimes when guys do, it is strange when guys do change locations. Sometimes their level of play changes too, whether it be they really had a fit with an offensive line coach they were with for 6 years in their career. And then they go somewhere else and it's a different line coach with different techniques like we're talking about. And damn it, we're doing it this way. I don't care if that's the way you used to do it. We're doing it this way. All of a sudden he's a different player. It's weird how some of that stuff unfolds. So I can understand why some teams have the philosophy and mindset of, in a perfect world, we want to keep our coaching staff intact for continuity, and we want to build through the draft and let that marriage happen. Let the same guys develop those players. If it's working, obviously if it's not working, you got to make adjustments. So there's no, you know, there's no 100% given truism, you know, on free agency or really anything else. I mean, if it were that exact a science, everybody would win every game, and that's impossible. But I would think about, I think they've got plenty of options inside, Dan. I think the veteran players are proven at the end of the season. They got, you know, Suofilo knows what he's doing. There's no question about it. And, they've got players, veteran players that played multiple positions and definitely can play guard. If you can play tackle, you can play guard in the National Football League. You know, do you develop Big Fred? I mean, all those things, that's what Frank's doing now, is he's trying to see how these guys play, looking at their body mechanics on tape. Does that fit the techniques that I'm going to, that kind of fits the techniques I'm going to try to teach here, and then go out in free agency of the guys that are available. Is that a better option, man? Look at this guy's body type. That's perfect for what I want done. That's perfect for how I want it done. All of that has to take place. But I do think if they could, find an improvement on the edge, that's where the rubber meets the road, I think, in free agency, if they can get it done.
From Marty, what will the Bengals do about a backup quarterback?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the one thing that you can't just worry about economics. But the thing about Finley, he's still on a rookie contract as well. So, you know, do you look at him as, is he a guy that can get you through a game? Or, boy, you need to make sure you have a guy like what happened this year, a guy that is going to have to get you through a handful of football games. Is that Ryan Finley? You know, and okay, the attractiveness is still on a rookie contract, but still very, very inexperienced. He won a big game for you with a very creative game plan. You got to go out and get something else, in my opinion. How much money do you spend on that backup quarterback? How much salary cap room do you try to take up in that regard? Did Brandon Allen do enough? You talk about a roller coaster. I mean, you know, quarterback rating within the 120s, over 75% completion percentage, and then the following week down to a squadouche, a big goose egg. So that's a meteoric. That's a heck of a rise and a big fall, man. That's a bigger deal than the Beast. That's peaks and valleys bigger than the Beast up at Kings Island. So, yeah, do you decide? I do think, though, they like him. I do think they like him. And I do think that his performances were based on who he was playing against. And you have to factor that in. But overall, do you think you can get through multiple games with that type of player? And they did, you know, and it was not – it was competitive. I mean, it looked like an NFL operation out there to me with him at quarterback. So I think you have to definitely evaluate him and then see what else is out there and how much does it cost?
Last one from Daniel. Would you re-sign Carl Lawson or Will Jackson if you could only keep one?
Yeah, that's the big if. And I'd probably make sure that I kept Lawson because – you don't have any pass rush. He's the only guy that gave you consistent pass rush. Now, Hubbard was injured, and when he came back to play, Sam emptied the effort, you know, bucket every snap. But even, you know, even a guy like Sam, physically you're only allowed, your body's only saying you can do so much with that bad elbow. So he was, you know, trying to do stuff with one arm, you know, and did it well. But, and I think he's going to be fine. That gives you a second option. But to me, you paid all this money for Trey Waynes. Never got a snap out of him. I'm saying, all right, if I lose Carl Lawson, what do I have up front? If I lose Will, at least I have Trey Waynes. And I thought he was one of the best in the league. I gave him a ton of money, you know, and at least I'd have somebody else there. Who's my guy if I don't sign Carl Lawson? And then you can address, you know, the position group in the draft. You know, it's like if I keep Carl Lawson and address in the draft or keep Carl Lawson and lose Will, like we were talking about, cornerback is a need. You know, maybe you have to move that position up even a little bit in terms of need. So free agency dictates draft. It always has and it always will, the yin and yang of that. But I don't know, which is easier to find in the draft? A real significant, meaningful pass rusher that translates well to the National Football League or a cover guy? That's a good question. That's a hell of a question. And what this particular draft, you know, if you're trying to decide who to sign in free agency, what's out there in free agency if I lose my guy? What's in the draft if I lose my guy at either one of those positions? which one can I afford to lose? Because there's more depth to fill that in other free agents we could sign and the draft potentially, or we can double down. So I think there's some, you know, a lot of thinking that goes into it. But in my mind, I still maintain if you can affect the quarterback right away with a good pass rusher, it's easier to cover back there. And I'm not saying you get anybody, you know, any Joe off the street to do it. It's not like that. But if I had my choice, which would you rather have? Would you rather have a pass rush that gives the quarterback less than 3 seconds, 90% of the snaps, or a secondary that has, you know, two really good corners? I'd take that pass rush. The other thing about Carl Lawson, Dan, is he affected the run game better this year. So if I'm building a defense, I want to make sure I can stop the run and rush the passer with that. That starts up front. And then the back end is the second. Okay, complement that pass rush with good coverage. Now you have to have guys that'll, you know, set an edge and tackle a corner, but you have to have guys that can affect the run and the pass. And Carl Lawson showed he's not a one-trick pony. He showed himself against the run a little bit. So to me, stop the run, put him in must-passing situations, have a pass rusher that can affect the quarterback, and then have Trey Waynes back there if you lose Will Jackson. If you have them both, that's even better. But if I had to pick one, I'd probably go with Carl Lawson, I guess.
All right, people are always asking me, when's Lapham going to get a Twitter account? I tell them it's never going to happen, but this is the next best thing. You have answered their Ask Lap questions.
Appreciate it, Dan, and you're exactly right. I think never's a long time, but not that long.
The Bengals Booth Podcast is presented by Bud Light Seltzer. It's light and refreshing with a hint of fruit flavor. Despite a final record of 4-11-1, there was a unit that performed well for the Bengals in 2020, the special teams. According to Football Outsiders, the Bengals graded out 9th best in the NFL in overall special teams play and 2nd in the AFC North behind Baltimore. Recently, special teams coordinator Darren Simmons joined Lap and me to discuss the play of his group. Darren, what were the bright spots for you in 2020?
Well, I think as a unit overall, anytime you don't give up a lot of explosive plays, block kicks, returns for touchdowns, that's one positive. I think the fact that we were able to pull together some guys really stepped up this year when we lost a couple players, you know, one of which there were core foundations, what we do like Clayton Fedgel. I thought we had some veteran guys really step up and play well and do a lot for us. You know, there's a couple guys that really come to mind. You know, early in the year, whenever Sean Williams was hurt, Giovanni Bernard really stepped up and fulfilled a couple roles until Sean could kind of get back after I believe it was a hamstring or calf, whatever he had there early on. And then Sean really played his tail off, and it was really a big part of what we did throughout the season. So I think, you know, being able for him to transition a little bit from his role on our team, from being a starting safety to being a core special teams player, was a really bright spot for me, something that I'm personally very proud of him of. I thought our punt team, in terms of phase work, I thought our punt team did a nice job really the whole year, with exception of maybe one play against Pittsburgh. We gave up a 40-yard return to McLeod. Otherwise, I thought we covered pretty well there. You know, I thought relative to the number of kicks we were getting to return, I thought our kickoff return team was solid. You know, we had an opportunity to even make a couple more plays, but I thought Brandon Wilson's play in that regard after he came back after an injury, or even before his injury and came back, I thought was good. So there were some bright spots. Obviously, I always want more. And, you know, anytime we set out in this thing, our goal is to be the best in the league. And we fell a little short of that. But, all in all, I was pretty proud of the way we played.
Football Outsiders always rate your special teams amongst the best in the NFL, and rightfully so. And in terms of actual kicking the football, Kevin Huber went into the last game 7th in the NFL in average and 6th in net. And then you obviously were evaluating Seibert over Randy Bullock down the stretch of the season. Where do you stand with respect to the seasons those guys had and what you anticipate for training camp in 2021?
Well, I'll start with Kevin first. Obviously, it was an important year for Kevin. He's an unrestricted free agent, so it was important for him to punt well, and I think he answered the bell as he has, you know, the last several years. I thought he got off to a really good start. He punted well up until probably the last couple games of the year. He had some issues that I know he probably didn't finish as strongly as he wanted to, but that's not going to show up a lot statistically. But I know he wanted to punt a little better down the stretch. You know, obviously it would have been unbelievable if we could have made the play on the 70, whatever it was, 2 yard punt yesterday. It would have been an unbelievable play to kind of help cap his season off. But all in all, I've been pleased with him. You know, it's such a weight off my shoulders to have somebody that I know and somebody that I trust, and somebody who knows exactly what I want out of each play and how to manage that, whether it's punting or holding, is a big deal to me. And he's continued to do that at a high level, I think. You know, and I think probably the last 2 years has been two of his better years statistically in his career. So that's pretty unique. He's kind of getting, he's really been able to hold his line of production, you know, over time and actually improve in some areas. You know, in terms of the kicking situation, it's something that we've got to talk about as a staff and as an organization as to what we do going forward. Obviously, Austin Seibert is somebody that is under contract. You know, he's still under his rookie contract because we claimed him from Cleveland. So he's still under his rookie contract. So he's still, under contract with us. Our discussion with Randy Bullock will take place here, you know, over the course of the coming time as to where we want to go. Randy's a free agent also. And how we want to approach that, if we want to have him back and have a competition for that spot in 2021. Again, it's still very early.
Sure.
And I don't have a concrete answer for that yet,
right,
unfortunately. But we certainly will over the coming days. But, again, it's obviously a position that we've got to get better production out of.
We're visiting with special teams coordinator Darren Simmons. Darren, after you re-signed this past season prior to this year, we had a long conversation, and you talked about your burning desire to win again. Obviously, you know, you do this because it's your job, partly, and you've got a family to support and all of that, but you've been in the league long enough where the ring is the thing. You're trying to win a Super Bowl title. How difficult have the last couple of years been for you personally?
Well, it's really been a struggle for me personally. It's like I told our players on our Saturday night Zoom, our last real meeting, special teams meeting. You know, I wrapped it up. I thanked a couple of our captains and really everybody in general. I mean, I've got such a special group of guys that, man, every time I asked something of them, they answered the bell. They never blinked. Everybody knew the landscape, the situation we're in with the pandemic and how different things were. I really appreciated their efforts this year because it is tough, you know, when you're not winning games, even though we may be doing some things and trying to contribute as much as we can in the kicking game. When you're not winning games, you don't feel the culmination of your work. You don't feel the positive side of that it affects enough. And, you know, I told our players, and I firmly believe this, I said, I coach this game for two things, for two goals. And number one, it's to win the Super Bowl. I mean, that's the ultimate goal that I have is to win the Super Bowl. We've obviously fallen short of that in my time here. I said the second one, the one thing I can't control is we do it for respect. And I think you do it for respect to your peers and, more importantly, respect to your opponents. So the one thing that you can grasp, Matt, is every time I go across the field at the end of the game to shake the other guy's hand, you know, I want to feel like I've earned his respect. And that's the one silver lining that I've been able to get out of it. But, again, it has been. I'll be lying if I said otherwise. It's been very difficult, to not win. That's something obviously we got to try to work to improve on just as a team in general, certainly us in the kicking game too. We all have a hand in it. We all have a hand in – everybody has a hand in when things don't go right. You just want to make sure you have a hand in when you're succeeding too. And we got to get more of that for sure. But it's really been a struggle.
You're not going anywhere. You're the best in the business, and the Bengals have you under contract. And you're an assistant head coach. You are a resource that if I were a head coach, I'd be tapping into. You've been here a long time. You've been here in successful times. You've been here in times that have not been quite as successful. You have a vast, huge knowledge of you're an encyclopedia, basically, of almost 2 decades of what's gone on here in Cincinnati. Do you feel like your opinions are going to be sought after? And if they're not, will you give them unsolicited?
Well, I want it to be certainly be a collaborative thing. I really appreciate the I did feel like after, if you want to call it gaining that title this past offseason, Zach did come to me with a lot of things, and that's something that I certainly appreciate, you know, that he entrusted my opinions, what my thoughts were when he asked for them. There's some things that I will give him if I feel it can help affect things or help things in some manner, I'm certainly going to give him my thoughts. That way, but in the end, ultimately, it's his team, and he wants, and he'll put the stamp on it that he wants, and he'll push the direction on it that he wants, whatever that may be. But again, I do feel like I'm a very big part of that. I do feel like my voice or my opinion matters to him. I think he certainly listens to it. And again, like I said, collaboratively, we got to put a plan in place that gets us to turn the corner here, that gets us to get back to the team that we've been in the past and really push us over the top. It certainly fell short of that. I don't think that's any secret. I hope going forward here after me having a year under my belt of being really in this role for the first time in my career that I can help him even more than what I have done in the past. And, we can help where I can help push things that I think would help us improve or hey, maybe we should think about doing it this way. Cause it is, I've been here a long time. I've been in this league a long time. I have knowledge of how, what my opinion may be or how I see other teams do things. And hopefully that will help.
That's going to do it for this episode of the Bengals Booth Podcast brought to you by Bud Light Seltzer. Refresh the game. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. And if you have a minute, give it a rating or share a comment. That helps more Bengals fans find this podcast. I'm Dan Hoard, and thanks for listening to the Bengals Booth Podcast.